Is exercise science a joke? Today's guest, Lyle McDonald, weighs in. We start by discussing his critiques of Brad Schoenfeld's research. We then broaden the lens to exercise science as a whole, his rift with the evidence-based circle, and the Mike Isratel debacle, before finishing with Lyle's personal training and nutrition regimen. I hope you find it an illuminating conversation. Hello again, Lyle. Pleasure to have you back.
Yep, it's been a while.
It has been a while, and maybe a couple of months. Anyway, since we last talked, I have some 70,000 new YouTube subscribers who possibly don't know you.
Yeah, that's nuts.
It is, actually. I can hardly believe it.
Yeah, that's
perhaps
crazy.
They've only heard of you obliquely through Mike Isratel calling you one of the most bad faith actors in all of fitness.
His name is Lyle McDonald, and this is like a person who is like maybe like one of the most bad faith actors in all of fitness.
He's also called you insane, cruel, mean, psychotic, and he said you have zero accomplishments.
Lyle McDonald.
Yeah, he said something about snowflake.
He's a terrible, insane person.
I've only met him through the 2-hour podcast we did together. I don't know if you guys were friends or
we're never friends.
You coached him or he coached
he,
you.
He has
remember.
Alienated every single expert in the industry because he is insane and cruel and mean and psychotic and has zero accomplishments.
You got me, Mike.
Well, you know, Mike used to have much nicer things to say about you back when he was trying to befriend you.
And Lyle, listen, I think you're f***ing brilliant, and I think you're onto a lot of real, really correct shit.
I have the utmost respect for Lyle.
Very respectfully, I think Lyle probably is smarter than me and knows a lot of shit, but...
Oh, yeah, I know we're going to talk about it, but if you go back and look at the debate we did, he was still like, we could still be friends.
I'm open to liking you, Lyle.
No. No, we couldn't. Anyway.
To me, Lyle is a friend. He is a mentor. And he will be my coach one day when I compete in natural bodybuilding. As a bit of background, Lyle, you used to be highly regarded by the current evidence-based circle, or circle jerk, as you like to call it.
Yes.
Eric Helms contributed an appendix to your women's book. Brett Contreras called you one of the most knowledgeable people in the fitness industry. You used to hang out with Brad Schoenfeld and Alan Aragon.
I mean, yeah, you know, and I visited like Alan. I was out in California once for an inline race. This was years ago. This was like early 2010s. And he was out there. So I went and hung out with him a little bit before I went up to my stupid race. So, yeah, I mean, I used to interact with all of them on, you know, some level.
Jeff Nippard had you on podcasts and worked for you on an affiliate basis.
Oh, yeah.
Milo Wolf
right.
was in your Facebook group for years. But now, as you were saying, you're basically at daggers drawn with all of these people. And from what I understand, the major falling out was around 2019 when you criticized Brad Schoenfeld's volume paper.
I had the gall to criticize a paper by the self-proclaimed greatest hypertrophy researcher in the world.
He describes himself that way?
Go to his website. Maybe he's just repeating what other people have called it. But
Brad Schoenfeld, for the unfamiliar, he's been described, at least by Mike Isratel, as the world's preeminent expert in muscle growth.
I'm here with Dr. Brad Schoenfeld, who is technically, literally, the preeminent expert in muscle hypertrophy, muscle growth research in the entire world. Dr. Schoenfeld is the world's literal preeminent expert on muscle hypertrophy, professor, and the world's ranking expert on muscle hypertrophy research.
Sure. And if you read his books, you'll realize that he had no jack squat.
So he has a PhD from Rocky Mountain University, which Brad described as having a hybrid PhD program that combined online and on-site coursework. But you're not so sure, Lyle.
No, because I got bored one day in the way that only I can. And I went and I trudged through the entirety of the PhD program. I looked up and I sent you the links. You can find the entire program. It's on an Amazon. And I sat down and I recorded every class that was mandatory or an elective in terms of whether it was online or on campus. And in a 4-year program, it required a grand total of 19.5 days on campus maximum. That was the maximum number of days. You could have gotten that done in 3 weeks. That is not a program with a hybrid online on campus. That is an online program with a microscopic on campus.
Brad's paper is titled "Resistance Training Volume Enhances Muscle Hypertrophy But Not Strength in Trained Men." So, Cyril, we start by sort of describing the paper.
Yes.
Then we can get your criticisms of it. And after that, we can discuss like the fallout of your criticisms, i.e. Sure. how did the evidence-based community kind of respond to you?
Yeah.
So correct me if I'm mistaken about any of these, but the purpose of Brad's paper, as I understand, was to compare the effects of low, moderate, and high resistance training volumes on muscle strength, hypertrophy, and endurance in resistance-trained men. So there were 34 resistance-trained men. They were randomly allocated to one of three groups for an 8-week training period. So all groups trained 3 times per week. Each session comprised 7 exercises targeting major muscle groups. So there was the flat barbell bench press, barbell military press, the wide grip, you'll find this funny, lateral pull down, as they call it, even though there's nothing lateral about it. It's for the lats.
Yes.
Anyway, that's a small point. Seated cable row, barbell back squat, machine leg press, and unilateral machine leg extension. So a lot for the quads. So all sets were reportedly taken to momentary concentric failure in the 8 to 12 repetition range, with the load to be adjusted on subsequent sets to ensure failure was achieved within that target range.
Right.
So coming back to the three groups, the low volume group performed 1 set per exercise, the moderate volume group performed 3 sets per exercise, the high volume group performed 5 sets per exercise. The researchers measured 1 rep max strength in the squat and bench press and muscular endurance in the bench press, and they measured muscle thickness using ultrasound at 4 sites, so biceps, triceps, and 2 locations on the thigh. Right. Notably, the ultrasound was not blinded. So here's what they found. So all three groups saw improvements in their 1 rep max strength and muscular endurance. However, there were no significant differences between the groups.
Right.
The low volume group gained just as much strength and endurance as the 3 set and 5 set groups.
Correct.
As to hypertrophy, there was a clear dose response relationship for muscle growth. The 5 set group gained more muscle size than the 1 set group, and the 3 set group also trended toward more growth than the 1 set group. The conclusions they drew, for resistance trained men, a very low volume of training, i.e. 1 set to failure per exercise, is sufficient to maximize gains in strength and endurance over an 8-week period. However, maximizing muscle hypertrophy requires higher training volumes with greater gains seen as the number of sets per exercise increases. So that's just an overview of the paper. And let's go back to the high volume, like 5-set routine. So as you said, they did 5 sets per exercise for a total of 35 working sets per session, and therefore 30 to 45 sets per muscle group per week. So 30 for the upper body muscles, right. 45 for the quadriceps. Again, with every set supposedly performed at the point of momentary muscular failure,
supposedly being the key word.
Yeah. For 8 to 12 repetitions per set, 90 seconds of rest between sets, and 120 seconds of rest between exercises.
Right.
But we've kind of gone awful technical, so I think it would probably benefit the viewer to describe what does it actually mean to perform this workout routine? Like, what is momentary concentric failure? I think that would be a good place to start before describing why the idea of people doing this workout as written is so very implausible.
Right. Well, so the topic of muscular failure is obviously somewhat complicated because there are a number of different definitions. Momentary concentric failure means that during the concentric, the lifting phase of the exercise, that you are unable to complete the repetition. So you have hit momentary muscular failure. Now, I've been in a gym for 30 years. You've been in a gym for many, many years. People listening to this, how many people have you ever seen take a back squat to the point that they were unable to complete? Because think about what happens on a back squat if you're unable to complete the repetition. Unless you have a spotter to step in and help you to the top, you're going to lower to the bottom and get stuck. That's what momentary concentric failure suggests, is you're unable to complete the lifting portion of the repetition. Now, I've done it. I don't recommend it. I've done it. I've squatted to complete failure where I got stuck on the bottom and had to dump the bar. Powerlifters may miss a rep with max single, but I dare say most of you have never seen anyone do this in a gym, certainly not deliberately. And to do that for five sets in a row on 90 seconds.
Three times a week, followed by other legs exercises, also correct. To momentary concentric failure.
Correct. For years, I said, look, show me the workout. Send me a video. Prove this to me. I've been saying for years.
Yeah, from what I understand, you've actually offered money.
Yes.
For people to complete the workout as prescribed. And no one has done it, right? Am I correct?
No. For this one, I said, look, if you think this workout is possible, if you think it's doable, I'll give you $1,000. Prove me wrong. It's real simple. And I said, do it exactly as written. I want to see 5 by 8 to 12 to momentary failure with exactly 90 seconds between sets and 120 seconds. Show me.
Is that offer still on the table?
I've only been waiting 6 years. I don't think anyone's going to do it if they haven't yet. And even when I said that, and I said, these researchers need to video the workouts because I don't believe them.
Yeah.
And Brad said, well, that would just require getting someone else, you know, having to pay someone. Oh, stop making excuses, because they did video. There was a study that came out last year looking at the length and partials things. They did video every set. It can be done. There are phones. Every one of your phones has a camera. Show me. Trust me. Show me. This workout cannot be done as written.
I've never done a workout that hard in my life.
To do 5 by 8 to 12 to concentric muscular failure, meaning you get stuck halfway up and need a spotter, and to do it again on 90 seconds, can't be done. One set can. Three sets, good luck, but five, can't be done. Especially not to be followed by leg press and leg extension.
It can be done, but I just find the idea of the participants doing it implausible.
And doing it 3 times a week for 8 weeks.
Yeah, three times a week for 8 weeks.
So number one, I find the workout implausible. Fine, maybe they're like, so they said they were going to adjust the weights. They would have had to be taking 30% off the bar every set, right? If you do a set to failure and rest 60 seconds, you'll have to lower the weight by 50% to get the same number of reps.
Mm.
So 90 seconds, let's call it. So yeah, if they were starting at, 275, they would have been taking 60 pounds off the bar every set. By the end of it, they would have been squatting with like 95 pounds. Which again, you're making up for low quality training with excessive volumes. So just try, anybody listening to this, just try them leg extensions. Do a set of 12 to true failure where you cannot finish the repetition. Rest 90 seconds and see how many reps you get. And then do it again and again and again and again. And send me the video. It's real simple. I'll put my money
on the leg extensions alone. It is excruciating. The protocol as described.
You would be breathing like you wouldn't get off the floor even if you managed to get through the second set through just sheer force of will, because you are the John Wick of the weight room. And I'm sorry, but these trained college students are not, right?
I'm telling you, Lyle.
Huh?
It would take me a lot more than $1,000 to do that workout.
Look, if people want to crap on me and tell me I'm stupid and I'm wrong and I don't know anything, cool. Prove me wrong. Because the fact that no one ever stepped up to try to prove me wrong means they know I'm right. It's just that simple. They can say Lyle's wrong all day, every day. Fine. Prove me wrong. Show me that it can be done. Okay, but hang on. There's actually more to my criticisms than just the fact that the
right. So, what other criticisms of the paper did you raise?
Okay, so a second one actually had to do with the statistics, because what you read, their conclusion that there was a dose response relationship, is absolutely not supported by the actual statistical analysis. They looked at p value. It's pretty much standard. You set p less than 0.05 means you've achieved statistical significance. And it didn't. There was no statistically significant difference in the growth for the different volume groups, according to the p-value. They didn't meet it. So, this is the only time I've ever seen Brad do it. They threw a different statistical method at it, something called a Bayesian analysis. number one, for upper body, the BF10 values were not different than zero. They did not support a dose response to anything. For the lower body, the BF10 values were something like 3. That's considered meaningless. So their conclusion that this showed a dose response relationship, neither statistical analysis showed that. Neither of them. Their conclusion that this clearly shows a dose response relationship is false. The statistics do not support that conclusion on any level. So that was number two. Number three was the lack of blinding for the ultrasound assessor, which is a huge source of bias. Now, for people that aren't aware of what blinding means in a research sense, let's say I'm testing a drug. If you know what the drug is, you may respond to it simply because you believe it's going to work. So if I'm going to do a single blinded study, I'll take 20 people. I'll give one group, 10 people a placebo, just a sugar pill, and 10 people the drug, but they don't know what they're getting. That's called a single blinded design. You, the subject, is blinded. Now, a double blinded study means that I, the researcher, don't know who got what, right? Because, like, let's say I know that this group got the placebo and this group got the drug. If I know that, when I go to whatever, ask them questions or study them later, my knowledge may impact the results. If I want to see the drug work, I might lead them to different answers. So double blinding means I don't know who got which drug. Now, exercise science has a problem compared to other fields. You cannot blind the subjects to the exercise intervention. Obviously, the study subjects know whether they got 1, 3, or 5 sets. Right? You can't do it. Not like if I give you a supplement or a drug. You can't blind the people overseeing the workout, which is potentially a problem. Let's say I'm in an exercise science class and I have taught the students higher volumes are better. Maybe those coaches, when they're overseeing the higher volume group, maybe they push them harder than they push the one set group because they don't believe in the one set train. Unfortunately, there's no solution to this, right? It is a limitation to exercise science studies. The subjects know what they're doing. The person overseeing the workout knows what they're doing, but you can blind the assessor, meaning you're blinding the person doing the measurements, and you should, because that is a huge source of bias. Depending on the method, right? Now, let's say I'm using DEXA to measure body composition changes, which isn't very accurate for muscle growth. Their blinding is not necessary there because you push the start button and the machine does the rest. Certain methods do not require blinding. But if you look at how ultrasound is done, basically you use an ultrasound wand and you look at the muscle, you take tracing paper and you draw over the image and then you use a ruler to measure the changes. If you, the assessor, knows that this is in the 9-set group and this is in the 45-set group, and you are biased because you believe in high volume training, I'm not saying it does. I'm not saying it did, but it can. It is a huge source of bias. Also, you can blind the statistician because the statisticians can do weird stuff with this. If they know which data is from which group, ideally you should blind the statistician. And I brought that up. And I brought up all those criticisms, and Brad blocked me and left my group. And then I was persona non grata in the entire internet fitness industry. Well, the circle jerk from that point on.
Well, this, Lyle, I just don't understand. Why? Why were you shunned by the evidence-based circle after
because Brad is above your criticism.
Expose?
Brad is above criticism in all their eyes because... And again, I'm not claiming that he did this. He controls their research and their financial future. They had to defend him because he is the ostensible head of the evidence-based fitness group. And I had the nerve to make him look bad, to bring criticisms that most importantly, they couldn't rebut because they never can.
Yeah, I'm sure their retort would be, it's not what you said as much as how you said it that made us cut ties with you.
Like 6 years later, all the people... I started getting emails a couple, 3 years later, PMs are like, yeah, so, after the fact, I think you were right about Brad's paper. I'm like, of course I was. Now get bent. Of course I was. Everyone acknowledges that paper is crap now.
Well, my perspective is that what you did was incredibly valuable. You know, you showed, hey, these workouts likely aren't what they claim to be. What they define as concentric failure likely isn't true concentric failure. Like, stop drawing strong conclusions from this study. Be more cautious, saying things like there's a dose-response relationship between volume and muscle growth. Well, shall we talk about exercise science as a whole? Because you and I, through our collective efforts, might be said to have painted a pretty grim picture of the whole thing. You with your critique, of course, of Brad's paper, me with my critique of Mike Israetel's doctoral thesis. Like, would you say these are isolated instances of sloppiness or sort of representative of the whole field? Because surely, I mean, if it's the latter, then this is a failing discipline.
So my mentor, who was a materials engineer, who had exercise as his hobby and passion, opined to me early in my career that he thought exercise science was a joke, basing it predominantly on the fact that small sample sizes, zero replication, unbelievably poor levels of control. You can't control diet. You can't control the subject. Like, you have to realize he studied rocks for the government. Like, he is a real party animal, right? Rocks have a variance of, you know, whatever, 0.001%. We know now that any two individuals in response to the identical training program can get a tenfold variation in response. Like, hypo and hyper responders to training are a thing. And it seems plausible that if you really wanted to, right? Like, when you do studies, you're supposed to randomize groups. You take all 30 people and you randomize them into each group. But like, if someone were not randomizing, and again, I'm not saying this is being done, but I could probably take 30 people and go, well, he's bigger than that dude. He's probably a hyper responder. Maybe I'll just put him in the group where I would like to see the results occur. Maybe. I'm not saying this is being done. I'm saying it could be done, right? And the same is true of most medical science. The difference is that with medical science, there's so many fewer variables, right? If you're testing out a drug, what do you have to test? Different doses, maybe different frequencies, and you can test thousands of people, right? The GLP-1 studies have like 3,000 subjects. Exercise science studies have the 35 people that are in the sports science class who are willing to give up 10 weeks to be in that study. Right? So you end up with these tiny sample sizes, rarely more than 10 to 12 subjects per group, huge variance. If you even look at the data for Brad's paper, like, yes, if you look at statistical averages, like, you know, there was like the low volume group and this was a little, but there's huge overlap. Some guys, people get more growth from low volume than moderate. And so you'll get more growth there's so much variance that when you look at averages, it really obscures the individual response. And better papers will present individual responses. And some people, you know, it's that. And other people will lose size on a given intervention, right? When you report averages, it really obscures the individual. I was in college. Now, I was a nerd in college, right? I spent my life either riding a bike or in the library. But I'm sorry, the average college student, they're not controlling their diet. They're not controlling their protein intake. Now, yeah, ideally, we would study elite athletes. Elite athletes can't give up the time to be in studies, by and large. There are exceptions. You know, Garth over in Europe land has had a cohort of elite athletes that they've put through studies. So it is limited as a discipline. And I dare say that resistance training research is far worse than rote endurance training research, right? Early on, exercise science was almost exclusively aerobic. Like, there was early strength training stuff, and it's some really funny stuff. With aerobic training, there's many fewer variables, right? Duration, intensity, modality. You look at weight training studies, you have, I won't say unlimited variables, but you could. Sets, reps, rest interval, training frequency, exercise selection, exercise order, tempo. Like, there is no replication in most weight training exercise science. You look at all these papers, they're all different. And they might as well be random. science is based on replication, because one paper doesn't mean anything. But when you're trying to compare a study that did so many sets twice a week to X sets three times a week to some number of sets once a week with different exercise choices, different definitions of failure, different set rep rest interval combinations, how do you compare these meaningfully and draw any sort of conclusion? Well, you can do a meta-analysis, and in a meta-analysis, you take all the data, and I equate it to taking 12 different colors of paint, mix them together, and deciding they're all gray, because invariably they average themselves out, and you end up with no, right? So you could do that. You look at them individually. You do like a narrative review, and I wasn't writing a scientific review, but the article I did on my website, I'm like, I'm just going to walk through each paper, look at the methods, look at what they did, look at what they measured. Did they blind the assessor? And in most cases, they didn't. And that is a huge failing in the field. Not just Brad's paper. This is true of many papers. Make no mistake. That was only, and he pulled it. Well, Lyle's never brought up blinding before. Dude, that was one of four issues I had with your paper. Stop. It's like when people focused on you going, oh, he's just focused on typos. Like, yeah, stop. Stop with the deflections. This is pathetic. It is... And there are some labs, you know, there are labs that do papers that they do. They'll blind the assessors and they'll blind the statisticians and they do a relatively better job. But it is a very difficult field. There's no doubt about it. It has a lot. And that's why a lot of people like animal studies, but rat studies almost never translate, right? Easy to control, but, you know, I mean, you've been training for a while. I've been training for 30 years. Or, well, training for 40 and professionally for nearly 30. And so I read these papers like, oh, you know, the subjects had 4 to 6 years of resistance training experience. So they're experienced. Well, but are they? I've known people that train for 20 years that were still beginners. If you look at their technique and their intensity and their focus, like that doesn't mean anything. That's why videotape the workouts, because I don't believe these things for a damn second. When I read some of these papers, I'm like, there's no way, because I don't care what the researchers say they did. My real world watching people and coaching, this workout cannot be done. Prove me wrong. Make $1,000. I'd think if people wanted, I think if people really believed they were right, they would want to take my money. And yet here we are. So yeah, I don't know if it's irredeemable. I think it has a lot of limitations that people are just don't care enough to try. Like I said, Brad wrote a bunch of really, really strongly worded papers about here's what we need to do to make it better. Yeah, certainly blinding the assessor, that should be mandatory.
I don't know if you recall, Lyle, but part of why I ask is that when we first met, you seemed a lot more cynical about the fitness industry. I think you felt your efforts to call out the evidence-based circle jerk were fruitless, and I planned this mammoth video with you, which we eventually ended up doing, but I think you saw my optimism as a bit naive at the time, like I was almost a younger version of yourself.
Yeah.
Perhaps yes. A dynamic not unlike like Luke Skywalker and Rey in The Last Jedi. But I'd like to think my approach ultimately worked.
I won't disagree with that. And this might have just come from, you know, the environment that I was coming up in, the reach just wasn't there, right? You know, you managed to do a video that completely exploded the internet. When you've got people not even in the fitness industry talking about it, something, yeah, like I wasn't like, yeah, fine, whatever. I can, you know, my YouTube channel of whatever, however many subscribers I had, you know, or my Facebook group, yeah, they already know who I am. They already agree with me. I don't do social media. Like I didn't like, yeah, I can put stuff on my website. Nobody cares. Especially when you've got all the big babies are like, I mean, anyone who went and asked Brad a question he couldn't address, he would just block them, you know, like the intellectually honest person that he is. Just like Lane does, just like they all do, because they all became what they used to criticize. And it's real easy to be right when nobody sees the criticisms, but you had a platform that allowed it to happen. So, I mean, whatever, like I said, I've been doing this for 30 years and it's been the same crap. You know, every 5 or 6 years, the new crew of people come through and I'm the lone or even the early 2010s. As far as I can tell, Lane is mostly irrelevant. Brad is retired. Mike's career is in shambles. Nippert got dragged down with him because he decided to, you know, hook himself to a sinking boat. All these guys are getting dragged down because they decided.
Why did Jeff Nippert do that? He could have just remained silent. I was on completely good terms with him.
I truly don't know why they would hitch themselves to that wagon.
It's perplexing.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I get it. You know, I get the nature of the internet. You know, you have to chase the algorithm. And I guess they figure, well, Mike's in the conversation, so I have to say something, but what a poor choice of, you know, horses to back on that one.
I think it's that they didn't realize that the ground has shifted.
Mm.
And it has, in a major way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, 5 or 6, you know, like I said, when this was going on with, you know, with Brad and I, probably it was a little bit different. Like the nature of things, you know, it wasn't, yeah, there were people that heard what I had to say, but it didn't have nearly the reach. It was very easy for them to quash the criticism and just make, you know, Brad could just put his trite, dumb excuses, and the midwits who follow him would eat it up, you know, all the crap that, you know, and those guys could, you know, like, fine, yeah, we'll just block Lyle. Nobody ever hear what he has to say. We'll just make sure that his criticisms go unheard, because I was too lazy to make YouTube videos and still am. That's why you're here, because you'll do the work and I'll just talk until people get bored.
It's a win-win. It's a pleasure to talk
and,
to.
And I think they were probably thinking that, oh, you know, Mike is still too big to fail. And 4 or 5 years ago, that might have been the case. But now, you know, and serious, like I said, watching the reach on this thing. And, I mean, God almighty, people tried to post up that Dorian reel in my group for weeks.
Okay. I guess I'm Mike's friend. He's not here. So, Dr. Mike, first of all, I hope that you're being, like, tongue-in-cheek.
And bigger and stronger than Mike Metzger.
Otherwise, I fear either for your eyesight or your mental health. Because obviously your physique's nowhere near Mike Mensah, even with all the PEDs that you're taking, that you estimate will take 10 years off your life. Well, maybe you need to ask yourself whether it's worth it, mate, because a bag of shit that gets bigger is just a bigger bag of shit. Still a bag of shit. You know what I mean, mate?
So I was like, nope, I'm not. I'll look at it. I think it's funny, but it's not going to my group. I think it's amazing. But yeah, so I do think, you know, now, and a lot of people are like, yep, Michael, just wait a few years till it blows over and, you know, wait for the new crew of people who don't know the history. And maybe, but I don't know. I think you're right that certainly things have shifted, because, oh my God, the comments section on all Mike Isertel and RP social media is just, they can't delete them all. They can try. They can't delete all. It's just, you know, and I've watched Mike trying to go on the apology tour. I saw a reel by him where he was like, yeah, you know, when I did those exercise science critique videos, I was maybe a little catty. Dude, it's too late. Sorry, you have dug your own grave on this one, buddy. You're not going to get away with, yeah, maybe I was a little excessive. Dude, you said Dorian wasn't doing enough. Seriously?
I think that if he would have trained maybe a little bit more, maybe 5 days a week, maybe he could have been even better. And I know it's not, it's a little rude, which I understand. And it's a little confusing when some worthless nobody like me says somebody else 10 times better than me at the very thing that I want to be good at could have done it better. It's weird. It's a weird vibe, but it's also true.
You're no exercise scientist. You're a joke. Somebody sent me a video and I didn't watch it, but I guess someone called Mike, Mr. Mike Isertel, to his face.
Yeah, Jeremy Ethier, major YouTuber.
Mr. Mike Isertel.
I get to be relevant today.
Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. I mean,
the editor crossed out doctor and wrote Mr.
I mean, but it's true. It really is. That PhD thesis is whatever. So yeah, I mean, I is it nice to be vindicated? Sure. Big picture stuff, is that why I do it? No. Like, not really. Like, yeah, it's great, but I mean, like I said, I don't care. I've never done this for accolades. Genuinely, I'm just like, and just I always like to point this out, because a lot of people are like, Lyle hates the fitness industry. No, that's actually
no. You love it and you want it to be better.
No, that's just it. I had dedicated my life to this since I was 15. When I was 15 and started doing sports, I knew with every ounce of my heart, this is what I wanted to do, was to give people the best information that I felt could be given to help them, and to see the morass of BS, to see the garbage that supposed experts, that supposed academics who use their platform to deliberately, knowingly, sociopathically mislead people, disgusts me. It's not the industry, it's the people in it. And not even everybody, because that's another one of those, and I did a little video on my thing, and I won't get too far into this. People are like, Moses can't stay friends with anybody. No, that's not true. I'm friends with plenty of people in the fitness industry, but it's the ones who actually know how to discuss and debate factually, going on 30 years now. It's only going to be better by degrees, right? There's only like, you know, we do our best. You put out good information. I try to put out, you know, the best information I can when I'm not just being an obnoxious a-hole, which is, you know, 40, 45% of the time, depending on what mood I'm in, because I think it's funny to say obnoxious stuff within limits. But yeah, like that's the best you can do.
Just to pivot, we've discussed plenty about how a bad training routine looks in the form of the training routine in Brad's paper. Mm. How about for a change, we discuss a good training and nutrition plan in the form of your own?
Okay.
I understand that you got in really good shape recently. You sent me the pictures. You're how old, Lyle?
55.
Wow.
Old as dirt.
You're not taking TRT or any anabolics, no. Are you?
No.
No.
Just, yeah.
So, I mean, before proceeding with a description of your current routine, I mean, we should probably discuss your goals first. You can correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I understand, you basically wanted to lose fat, preserve muscle, and stay in one piece both physically and mentally, i.e. don't get injured. Don't do something so hard you can't stick to it.
Yeah,
is that broadly correct?
But yeah, so my training is basically to stay in one piece. And I don't like being in the gym anymore because I just don't enjoy it like I used to. Not that I was ever in the gym a lot. So I'm really good at intensity because that's how I trained when I was younger. So most of the time, and I do exclusively machines at this point.
So your current training routine, you don't like training, so you don't train often, but it's high intensity, low volume. They're brief, in and out, machine based workouts.
Basically, yeah. My lone free weight exercise is a dumbbell curl because I don't like cable curls. Don't seem to work well for me, and I don't like most machine curls. So basically, what I do most of the time, if I'm just like training generally, I do rest pause, sort of dog crap style rest pause training. Which means specifically that means you do an activation set of like 8 to 10 reps to failure, concentric muscular failure, meaning I cannot complete the repetition despite maximal effort, right? Mm-hmm. Then you rest 15 to 20 seconds, and I just count it off in my head because I can do that. And then you do a mini set, and you do as many as you can do. And I almost invariably get 3. 15 to 20 seconds, another mini set, I get 2, 1, and then I'm done. Because once you get 1 rep, you're going to get 0, right? So that is my bread and butter training.
So because you go, say, 10, 3, 2, 1, all done. To failure. Yeah,
correct.
Done.
And then, you know, and then I use a double progression. Is if I get 10 reps on the activation set, I'll go up in weight, and that'll bring it to 8. For a while, briefly, I was doing 8s and 12s, but I lose track. I can't count that high anymore. And I get bored, quite honestly.
So you just do 8 to 10 on everything now? On the activation set?
Yeah. And when I get to 10, cool. I want to go up, I add weight. It's real simple. And I do an upper-lower ABA split 3 days a week. Like, that is sort of my bread-and-butter training, right? No workout. I'd say lower body takes me about 30 minutes. And because of my hip, I'm really limited in what I can do. So my leg workout, I can't do squat patterns because I don't – the hip the femur doesn't rotate in the joint anymore, right? It doesn't move that way because it is ground flat. I saw the ultrasound. Wasn't a blinded ultrasound, but it was an ultrasound when I got the injection. So I do leg extension. I do them in a very specific way to make it as hard as possible. Then I do a leg curl with hip extension, which is a movement most people have never seen. Calf raise, and I do them in a way that I've been teaching for, God, 15 years. And I'll run that twice for the leg extension, rest, leg curl, rest, calf raise, leg extension, leg curl, calf raise. And then because I'm a masochist and still need to feel a little mas macho, I'll go finish with hack squats for rest pause.
So and it's two circuits of the leg extension, leg curl, calf raise. And then you've moved on to hack squats.
And then I go to hack squats for one rest pause set. And then I lay down for a minute because it's brutal.
Is the leg curl, leg extension circuit, is that also dog crap rest pause?
All of it.
Yeah. That's a brutal leg day.
The hack squats are awful. But I did 20 rep squats back in my youth, like endlessly. But, you know, by the time you've done a grinder set of eight on hack squats to have to go again in 20 seconds. And because I'm me on my final mini set, that final rep, I do a 2 second pause at the bottom just before I come back up. Why? Because I can. It's simply me showing off. I used to do that on back squats when I was younger. Why do I do it? Because I can. So that's my lower body day.
Let's hear about upper.
Upper body day. So I will typically do, and I alternate superset again, just to save time. So I'll do like hammer incline press, hammer high row, right? The high low row, hack deck, shrug back.
So it's like a row without bending of the elbows.
Yeah. Dumbbell incline fly, which again, I teach a very specific way. And we've got a fantastic old school Nautilus pullover machine. So that's chest and back, three sets, dog, again, all rest pause. And my rest interval between sets is however long it takes me to limp across the gym to the machine, which is about a minute. I don't move real fast anymore. Then shoulders, we got a lateral raise machine. So I'll do that, a reverse pec deck, and then cable upright row and face pull.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'll do tricep pushdown, dumbbell curl, like the tricep press. It's like a machine nose breaker. And then we've got a one curl machine that I like that I'll kind of scoot my butt and make it like an incline curl.
Right.
And I'll do that. And so it's a longer workout. That's like 14. So lower body is 6-7 sets, and that takes me about 30 minutes. Lower body is like 12 sets, and it takes me 35 to 40 if I dawdle. 30 if I'm in, or if I actually kind of move. Because like a dog crap rest pause, that takes about 2 minutes. So that's my bread and butter. And again, I do upper lower, and I do an ABA split. So I just alternate workouts. So each workout gets done 3 times every 2 weeks, about every fifth day. And I find for old farts like me, that's a much better frequency. Like I tried 4 days a week briefly, and I'm too old. And I don't like being in the gym that often, right? Like that's the bigger issue. Like I don't, because with upper lower, like you can move a day forward or backwards. It's way more flexible. So that's kind of my bread and butter training for maintenance. And I'll basically kind of eat on those days. And then I often will just do like RFL days in between. Like that's my easy maintenance.
Will you change anything about your routine to gain muscle?
No, I'm just going to go back to dog crap with the mini sets and more of a surplus. No, I'm not going to change anything. It was working.
Had you taken out those mini sets during your diet? Sorry, that remains a little unclear to me.
No, yes. During the entire diet, I just went to concentric failure and that was it.
Right, I didn't know.
That was my volume reduction.
I thought you were doing multiple like dog crap sets every workout.
Not during the diet.
Right, okay.
That's off season, whatever you want to call it.
I understand.
No, during the diet, my volume reduction is to drop the mini sets.
Yep, that makes sense.
And just because I'll be honest, on RFL, dog crap is tough. You really gas on the mini sets. So for me, it was real easy. You just drop the mini sets. I just do a set to failure and stop. And if you look at it in terms of effective reps, it's about a 50% reduction in volume.
Makes sense.
But I went ahead and maintained that 3-day-a-week training structure. So I stayed with the upper lower, and I simply took each set to concentric failure and stopped.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about your nutrition plan. So basically on maintenance days, sorry, on your training days, you eat at maintenance, and on your rest days, you... do rapid fat loss.
Let's call it maintenance. I don't really count things because I'm just too tired. I just eat. I eat a lot of bread, fruit, meat sandwiches. I do have cereal post-workout. I learned that from Mr. Mike. So, and then, yeah, then I just do RFL on the off days. Because for me, I don't want to track. I don't want to have to count. That's the easiest maintenance for me.
And for the unfamiliar, rapid fat loss is a diet that you devised. It's in your book, The Rapid Fat Loss Handbook. And there are basically five tenets, from what I understand. So you eat just protein, right?
Yes.
So only trace carbs and fats.
Lean proteins, trace carbs and fats, veggies.
Like a cup of steamed vegetables with each meal.
Yeah.
So you got your essential fatty acids in the form of the fish oils, like you just said.
Yep.
Electrolytes. And,
yeah, I just use low salt and just salt the crap out of everything.
Multivitamin.
Yeah, yeah.
That's basically it.
Yeah, pretty much. And it's the goal of that being, when I wrote that back in 2004 and updated it in 2008, the goal was to provide all of the essential nutrients, meaning the essential amino acids, we just use protein, essential fish oils. We can debate whether vegetables are essential or not, but they provide micronutrients and it's nice to poo every once in a while. You need electrolytes to offset the losses that occur with low carb. The goal of it being to provide all the essential nutrients in the lowest possible number of calories. And that's so you get the maximum fat loss since it's got sufficient protein, no muscle loss, especially resistance training. And I just find that it's, for me, it makes maintenance easiest because it means I don't have to track 7 days a week.
Yeah.
I just eat what I want on my training days and then I do RFL on the 4 days. And I tried some different patterns over this year when I leaned out at one point and then I went and that's when I did like 4 training days a week and 3 RFL days. And I found that my body fat started coming back up. So I'm like, okay, clearly that's too many. So that's when I reverted to 3 and 4. And I'm like, that's the sweet spot for me, right? Training, like I said, I'm in and out of the gym with 30 to 40 minutes. So I'm good at intensity. I just get to, and I get more done in that time than most people get pissing around for 2 hours. And then eat RFL the other 4 days a week, and it's easy, and I can move things around.
I'm going to ask you a question that I know you hate, but I know you also acknowledge that people also find it really helpful.
Uh-huh.
So I'm going to ask that you hold your nose and answer anyway. What do you eat in a day on your RFL days?
Oh my God. Okay.
I know. This helps. People like
Yeah.
This.
So whenever people ask me this question, they get the obnoxious answer. They're like, what do you eat on RFL? I go, lean protein, veggies, seasoned with existential dread. That's my go-to answer because I think I'm hilarious. But it is. Like, it's not the easiest diet, but honestly, people make it out to be it's way worse than it is. Like, plenty of lean protein, veggies. Like, what do you... That's the base of any diet. And with the ADF pattern... Well, when you've got
what about yours specifically? I mean, what lean protein sources are we talking about?
Okay, so... In a typical RFL day, usually one meal would be, honestly, I'll have 2 scoops of whey protein in fruit punch, Crystal Light, with some guar gum to slow down the digestion, and that's it. So there's 50
grams. It's like a protein slurry.
Yeah, I think sludge is probably a better description for it, but yeah, basically. So that's one of my meals. And I target at my body weight and body comp and lean, you know, I target about 200 grams of protein a day. So I just eat like, and I don't do strict time restricted eating. I usually eat at like 12, 3, 6, 9, or size 3, 6, 9, just depending on what I want to eat. Okay. So that's meal number one, invariably. Meal number two, I'll have 1 scoop of whey protein and 5 slices of nasty Costco ham eaten straight out of the container for 25 grams of protein. I don't put anything on it. My dogs love it because they get to share. So boom, that's it. There's another 50 grams. Generally, my next meal is Costco has these giant cans of canned chicken that are right about 50 grams of protein per can. So I'll have one of those. I'll use just enough light ranch dressing to make it edible. I mean, we're talking a teaspoon or two.
Sure.
And then I'll steam up some broccoli and cauliflower and mm-hmm. salt the crap out of it. So that's meal number three. Mm-hmm. And then meal number four is almost without exception, two big lean chicken breasts grilled with soy sauce over, we've got this konjac rice. It's that zero right. carb that it's like eating, it's just goo, with another cup of steamed vegetables. And that's it. And then I'll have a couple fish oil caps because I got some high concentration, and boom, done. So there's my 200 grams of protein. I just eat that every RFL day.
And the maintenance days, they're just whatever you want, basically.
I mean, they tend to be more consistent than not because I just tend to eat sort of the same thing. So like a typical day would be, you know, so I'll go train in the morning, then I'll go to the grocery store. Like I'll get like a Metrix bar because I like them. And I'll have that with, like I said, my bowl of Cinnamon Toast Crunch with milk, because I love milk, always have. Can't digest it, but I love it. And I got to take the milk pills. It's a Middle Eastern thing. Brown folks, by and large, don't digest dairy very well. So I just take milk pills. So I'll do that and have like half an apple. And then, you know, a few, then I'll have like two big either canned chicken sandwiches with another apple and a glass of milk. Or yummy. I'll have the ham sandwich. I'll do ham, five slices of ham apiece. There's 50 grams of protein plus my milk, another 60 grams. Apple. My treat these days is bread with grape jelly on it, because that's yummy. What I like, because I grew up on it.
That's delicious.
And then dinner is almost invariably same Costco chicken breast, but now I have it with veggies and sticky rice, because I love sticky rice. And I'll put like what I have now is like sweet and sour topping. So it's like very like, and that's kind of what it is, right? Like you've got RFL is just protein, veggies. And then all you're doing is like, I take the same base foods and I just add carbs, and then I take them back out, and then I add them and take them back out. But I'm eating the same. And that's when I set up RFL, and this is in the book, is, you know, that should form the base of your diet anyway.
Yeah.
Plenty of lean protein and veggies. All you're doing is adding and subtracting to it, mainly to facilitate people moving back into maintenance. They've established those eating habits. So like I have more protein drinks on the RFL days just because I do get tired of eating plain meat. But again, Metrix bar doesn't really count. And it's like a candy bar. So like that. So I just, that's it. And I eat the same foods pretty much, you know, on the off chance I might go out, which is very rare. I'll have something else. I'll just make sure and make a training day on that, like, you know, whatever, if I'm going out for dinner with a friend or something. Yeah, I'll just move my training day, make sure it falls on that day, and I'll just eat whatever.
So you retain some flexibility with your current approach.
Yeah, basically. Yeah. So that's great. That's sort of like my bread and butter maintenance program. But if I decide I want to get leaner for some reason, I do, have to put a little bit more effort into it. And so that's what I decided to do about a month ago, was like, okay. Like, and I think my body fat had gone up a little bit. It was just summer. Like, again, my hip, my activity is really curtailed. Even walking my dogs is not the most pleasant experience. Cardio is out because this hip just doesn't move like that anymore.
So no cardio. It's
time to lean out. So what I did this time, and I've done different things. I wanted to get, you know, like you can maintain that structure. You have the maintenance days and the RFL days, but like I'd already established that was maintaining my body fat. I needed more RFL days. So I decided to go to strict RFL and do it every day. But I went ahead and maintained that 3 day a week training structure. So I stayed with the upper lower. And I simply took each set to concentric failure and stopped without the mini sets. My leg workout now dropped to 20 minutes, right? It was 7 sets to failure. It's 20, and that's only because I got to change shoes for the hack squat. It would be faster except for that, because I got to put my lifting shoes. Upper body, I can power out in 30 minutes. So I just dropped to that and went to strict RFL 7 days a week. And did that for the first couple of weeks. And then it started to get a little grindy as I got leaner. And I had just some other things where I was just like, okay, like there was a day, you know, I'm like, okay, at like week two, I'm like, okay, I was kind of in the mood and I was meeting a friend for dinner and I'm like, I'm going to go ahead and do a couple high carb days, mainly because I wanted to see what happened to body weight and waist and just look at those dynamics. And what I did on that week, so rather than going upper, lower, is on the day that I was going to have my higher carb day, I did full body. So I squished the upper and lower workouts together, which made it take about 50 minutes just to set up for the higher carb day to give the carbs somewhere to go. So I did that for a couple of days. Then I went back to strict RFL. And I think I made it another week, 6 days. And then I had another higher carb day. So I did a 1 day carb load. And then I think I had another one the next week. And then the following week, I basically got to where I wanted to be, which was full six pack, veins down, you know, my sides, serratus, dry. And so I finished up Saturday morning. This was last Saturday. Because I think the lowest I was right. Like 152 at the end of the diet. With the Navy calculator put me at like 8.5% full six pack. I've got a little loose skin around my lower abs, but you know, like I said, obliques and veins and everything there. And then rebounded up to about 159 over 2 days. And waist came up a little bit, but that's just food in the gut. Like, honestly, like skin folds were the same, visually the same. And then, so that was it. So it was basically, you know, wasn't totally strict RFL, but it wasn't like I didn't do alternate like ADF. I didn't have like two specifically planned higher carb days. It was kind of like, oh, well, since I'm going out and having dinner with a friend and I'm going to eat carbs, I'm just going to do a full body workout this morning, which sucked. And then go eat carbs today and then go back to RFL. So, and you can see this in my weight just kind of goes down. It goes boom and down and bump and bump. And then it comes up and stabilizes.
And Lyle, in conclusion, where can people find you aside from my YouTube channel?
Yeah, so, you know, my website, bodyrecomposition.com, 400 some odd articles. I don't update it anymore because honestly, I got nothing to say. All my products can be found at store.bodyrecomposition.com, including the Rapid Fat Loss Handbook. All my
discount
other books.
Code, Mike has no 10.
Yeah,
10%
but,
off. Are you going to run a new discount?
No, let's do, I think we should do a Christmas code to run through the end of December. The question is what Mike still has no tan. That seems to be a little redundant.
Is there something else he doesn't have?
15% off until Christmas. Mike has no pro card.
I love it. That Mike will has not, no pro card, 15%
that,
off.
That will not stack with the Mike has no tan coupon, but it will stack with my vault with if you buy multiple books, you get discounts. It will stack with that. So coupon code Mike has no pro card, all lowercase, 15% off any order that includes my consultations, any of my books. And for those of you that want my GLP-1 book, it is on Amazon, but you can also get it on my website and you can buy it as part of a multiple book package. So yeah, store.bodyrecomposition.com. Mike has no pro card, 15% off until December 31st. I have a very active Facebook group, bodyrecomposition.com. I'm there every day. One thing I always like to point out, my group has tons of smart people who are experts in everything you could name. Topics I know nothing about. I was helping a friend today. She wants to get into bouldering. And I asked, can anyone recommend shoes? Because I knew nothing about it. I've already got a dozen responses. People like, I've been bouldering for 10 years and here's what you should do with shoes. Like my group has experts in everything you could even think of. So if you've got a question, if I don't know the answer, or if I just think I know the answer, someone will. I have an Instagram. I don't use it. It's called @McDonaldLyle. It's either dad jokes, pictures of my dogs, or the occasional video. I've done 2 videos on my YouTube channel this year, and that's probably the extent of it. I don't mainly my video content will be found on Solomon's channel.
Great.
I'm not on TikTok. I'm not on Twitter. And I'm not going to be, so don't ask.
Fantastic. Thank you for joining me again, Lyle.
Thanks for having me.
It was a pleasure to have you.
Always.